meeting will come to order. We have a full agenda, and so we'll get right into the first presentation. We don't yet have a quorum, so we'll wait to move on the minutes. But this morning we have the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs here for a bonding overview. And I don't know who's going first, but whoever the first speaker is, if you'd identify yourself for the record, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Mike McKelleny, the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And so this morning I just wanted to make a few brief opening remarks, and then I'm going to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Mike Gallucci, who will take you through the presentation.
And members, you do have that in your package. Members, we've also invited Representative Murphy to join us at the table because this is an area that comes under her purview, and I think you've already heard a number of bills in this area.
That's correct.
So, Madam Chair, first I wanted to make very clear that this is a capital investment bonding overview for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. This is the recommendations that we presented to the governor, but we are unaware what his decisions are, if there's going to be a bonding bill this year. So I wanted to make that very clear that this is just what we have recommended to the governor. And along those same lines, as we mentioned to other committees, we wanted it to be clear to everyone that rightly or wrongly, MDVA does not ask for excess. We don't pad our budgets. We ask for what we believe we can justify when we come to the legislature. So we wanted to make that clear that if some negotiation is to take place in the dark sometime in the future, we're not hoping to receive half of what we ask for. So we want that to be absolutely clear.
They do that?
As we look at the war cycle for my generation, the 9-11ers, it's been over a decade of war. One of the things that we're looking at is survivors like myself that are going to be with us for the next 50-plus years. When we look at some of the injuries that the 9-11ers have sustained, we're looking at TBI, PTSD, and amputations as some of the signature injuries. I myself was, rightly or wrongly, the first amputee, the first U.S. amputee in the war on terror. And so I've been living with a prosthetic now for well over a decade, and all the experts tell me that I'm going to suffer or potentially have additional effects later in life just because of that injury. I feel great today, but there will be care that I will probably need in the near future. One of the things I wanted to mention, which I think is kind of pertinent to today's discussion, Senator Al Franken, as well as many of the other congressional members, often come to the various veterans' homes. And what I think is really unique and brings context to what we're trying to do today is when he meets with the residents, specifically the World War II residents, he always opens with the remark of, oh, so you're part of the crew that saved the world. And so at MDVA, we believe what we are doing is taking care of all the veterans that have taken care of us. So we take that mission very seriously. So with that, I just wanted to provide a little context. I want to let you know, Madam Chair, we are here to help you make the best decisions that you can relative to the veterans' homes. And we appreciate your support, whatever that may be in the future. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Deputy Gallucci, who will take you through the briefing.
Welcome, Mr. Gallucci, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Gallucci. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Healthcare.
Please continue.
Thank you. here is my agenda. I apologize. I have a little frog in my throat. Result of different climate changes, apparently. The agenda, a little brief history, and then a discussion of the construction requests that we have, asset preservation, a discussion briefly on the federal match process for you, as well as some scenarios that we've looked at with options, and then obviously entertaining any questions during the presentation that you so desire, Matt. Minneapolis Homes, as you know, was a three-phase project, started back in 2010, and considered at that time to be able to be a campus master plan that was presented to the legislature and approved. Phase one was the building of a 100-bed skilled nurse facility. That was completed in July. We actually took occupation of that building, moved residents in, and in July, and then had a grand opening that many of you attended. The total cost for that was a little over $29 million. Currently, it is pending CMS certification so that we will have the ability to bill Medicaid, Medicare, and also doing third party. Additionally, we are preparing to enter into what is phase two. We've already started building 16, which is a 50-bed domiciliary. It is the renovation of that building, and its anticipation to be completed in June, with occupation by that time in June of this year. The total cost for that building and 17 North, which will start construction in this spring, if spring ever really gets here, of this year, is estimated to be just under $33.5 million. I'll point out here in 17 North that as well as in Building 19, Phases 1 and Phase 2, a considerable amount of infrastructure was transferred down and moved down into Phase 3. Those infrastructures were items such as the tunnel network that will connect the campus as electrically, will run our ITs through there, will give us the ability to transfer supplies and food as well as personnel movement, much like the tunnels here within the Capital Region. Our third and final phase, Building 17 South, which is a pre-design that was given to us and last bonding for $3,050,000, includes that infrastructure that I was just discussing with you. It ties the campus. Without that infrastructure, Madam Chair, what happens is that these are literally buildings standing almost entirely by themselves. And that infrastructure is critical in order for us to service in an efficient and effective way. Our anticipated cost is $54.1 million. We have selected the architect, and we are preparing to work through some of that pre-design right now, and we're waiting for some other information of costs that are being related to 17 North before we could start. The anticipation of 17 South's completion would be somewhere around the first quarter of 2016. Separately, we have Building 13, which is the Central Pharmacy, and it's a separate project. We received $1.366 million in 2012 for design of a new building that would centrally provide for the pharmacy to take care of all the medical, or I mean all the pharmaceutical needs across the five homes currently. That is also right now tied to Medicaid, Medicare billing, Part D, and we've just, as a good revenue stream that will, it has already turned $2 million in the last year on that. And we anticipate that to continue to grow.
And then just doing the math on this page, so are there currently 250 beds? And after this next project, it would be 350 beds? Or is this 91 over and above that?
Yeah, the 91 beds are the beds that are in the original old soldiers' home. So you have 100 beds in Building 19, you will have 100 beds. Well, you have 91 beds in Building 6, and you have 100 beds currently in what is Building 17, which is 17
I'm just
south.
For a total, so is
291.
250. What is it?
291, ma'am.
291. 291 currently.
No.
And after the project...
Oh, right, I'm sorry, 341 currently.
341 currently. So
correct.
250 plus 91.
And then with the completion of Phase 3, we will add 100 beds more for a total of 441 beds on the campus once the DHS approves the additional 100 beds, which we have already been in discussion, and that's not an issue. We're well below the cap of the VA's approval, and so we see nothing that's going to hold us back from that. And all three buildings will then be CMS, will seek CMS certification.
So currently 341 beds, 441 after the, after
yes,
the
ma'am.
Next project. Okay, continue.
This is just the configuration currently of what stands, and I guess the best way to show you is you see Building 17 is this somewhat funny looking picture in the middle, and what that is right here, I guess this isn't going to work as well as we would like, but Building 17, half of that building will be knocked down. If you take the next slide, this is the rendering that we currently have, that we project 17 south will remain standing, and then you have 17 north is this new, I wish this would work a little better, if this is 17 north right here. This will be 17 south. This is building 19 up in here, up at the top corner. And building 6 is adjacent to it. Next slide. Here's the potential configuration with phase 3 included. I'll point out that this is just a rendering at this stage. We're not sure. We'll want to look at how that 17 South will actually be fit into the campus, and that's what the purpose, obviously, of the pre-design will be. But the initial rendering showed it as being like this and connected with some corridors throughout the campus, leaving the great lawn open for everybody. So, Madam Chair, this is Building 17 South, 100-bed skilled nursing. And I'd like to say, I know that this says $54.1 million and it's 100 beds, but you're getting a lot more than 100 beds with this $54 million. It's designed, obviously, to include the tunnel distribution throughout the campus. That includes the HVAC and utility distribution. Dietary and housekeeping services will move between the buildings seamlessly between 619 and 17, as well as being able to move other supplies as required, and IT throughout the entire network. It also is an upgrade to the electrical units and the plumbing that is needed in order for us to obviously add 100 beds to the system and be able to properly protect the environment that we're there with the Minnehaha. It's a flexible design designed for continuum of care, and is currently the goal here is to be able to allow, as Mike pointed out, as residents become older and their needs become different, we'll be able to flex to those types of needs.
And I don't know that you say it in here, but as I recall from our conversation, Had we funded this in the last few years, it would have been about $30 million state, which would, and we were in the federal queue, and there would have been federal dollars. We have, we are now out of the federal queue, and so that's why the state, if we moved forward with this project, the state would have to come up with the entire 54.1.
Yes, Madam Chair, you're accurate with that from the standpoint that when we came on, when I came on board, this is my first year, when we reviewed this application, we were able to determine that there were a number of things that weren't included in the application that would be eligible for reimbursement from the federal government. A big chunk of that was being able to anticipate what the capital project interest would be, and a project that stays off for 4 or 5 years before it would be built, as well as some of the FF&E that goes with that as well. So we included that in our current. We took ourselves purposely off after not receiving our bonding last year, which was $17.5 million. We took ourselves off the board because we realized that that 17.5 was not going to be enough for us to build Phase 3. And so we reapplied at the 54.1. We're asking for a full funding because of the capital, VA's capital project been reduced from 283 in fiscal year 12 to $85 million in fiscal year 13, and our anticipation of 2014, which is where this application lies, will probably be somewhere between 83 and 100 million we're hoping for. So for the nation, and that's a considerable increase, or decrease, I should say, of the VA's capital projects grants. So 35% is a nice number which is the state's matching fund requirement. But if you only gave me 35% and the federal government didn't give me the 65%, we'd have to rethink how we're going to continue Phase 2 and move through, if anything, on Phase 3.
Okay, continue.
This slide is our asset preservation request at $5.3 million. As you know, much of our asset preservation is over in Minneapolis and has been, with those older buildings, but at the sacrifice of many of our outer homes as well. Most of our homes were built in the early 90s, or some of them even renovated afterwards, the late 80s, mid-90s. And so just being able to continue to keep upkeep them and also provide for new technology and new things such as lifts that help move patients and reposition them and assist them, and at the same time, those lifts also have been proven to help us with reduction in workers' compensation. So those were important issues, and so we've looked out over the other homes this coming year and said there are some significant things that we need to do for our homes. Hastings, being the one that has the largest, other than Minneapolis, for some renovations. Those will be things such as replacing chiller units, roofs, repairs to some general infrastructure up in Silver Bay. Minneapolis's money is primarily dealing with some deep tunnel waterproofing that they have of tunnels that they currently have that are connected to water mains, as well as the preservation of some of the historic porches and such like that in Building 6. Next slide.
So on this summary sheet, then, the amount of the total request that would be going to the Minneapolis location would be 55.7, because of the asset preservation, 1.6 is for Minneapolis.
Correct, 1.6.
So Minneapolis would be 55.7 of the total request.
Yes.
Continue.
Thank you, ma'am. Next slide. Our bonding request, then, Madam Chair, is that we would hope that the legislature would commit the $54.1 million so that we can complete this campus and be able to start focusing on other things within our system, as well as an agency-wide asset preservation of $5.3 million. Next slide. Try to give you a little bit of an update on the VA grant program initial applications. All of the applications of Section A within the federal government need to be there by the 15th of April. And any community that's submitting for an application must fill that form out. Many of them utilize the 2009 community study that I know that you're familiar with, ma'am. They take in consideration veteran population as well as medical staff and the ability to be closest to 100 minutes from homes, within 60 minutes of a CBOC or a medical VA center, and a presence of an actual licensed hospital in the area. Minnesota, by the VA statute, is authorized 1,058 beds, and with the completion of 17 South, we would have 914. So we would have the ability in the future to continue to look at the possibility of future homes should the legislature and the governor so desire to do that. All of our applications have a project description and schematics. We have done so with Minneapolis, again, the initiative for the 17 South. And currently we have before them Montevideo, who updated their application, which was filed originally in 2010. We've submitted a Bemidji application, and we have submitted a Brainerd application. We have advised the latter two communities that they were going to need to do some additional work since the criteria of resident-centered care that the VA initially was using has changed a little bit to a community living center. And we've provided both of those communities with the documents so that they can go back to their architect and have schematics done by the 15th.
We have a couple of questions. Do you want to ask them now or have him complete the report, or what would you?
They can complete.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. All safety project applications require documentation as addressing why it's to the threat, and that it is an accredited institution. So in that process, there are many priorities that go through. And what happens is, as you'll see on this next slide, this timeline that is utilized by the VA to determine how they go about assigning the monies eventually to everybody. So in a regular year, and this is a timeline from the VA for their fiscal year, initial applications due by the 15th of April. They started in February, and as I said, we have gotten four. We have four current applications there. They take them, and they move through and they do their checklist to the grants. And frankly, I'm not been able to sit at the table at the VA to see how they really go through their checklist. But they have given us a set of criteria that they are following. This represents in the next phase conditional awards. This is representative of what they're doing with the current $83 million. In my discussions with them yesterday, these 39 projects that you see in phase two in May are carryovers from last year that they feel were safety and health issues that they couldn't finance last year, and they're looking to see if that these folks may be able to be financed. In June, they do the final grant applications by the 15th of June, and then a project bids are approved by the VA. And the states submit after June. Submitting after June will be delayed until the following year. It's in this time frame because of fiscal years that our state fiscal year that the federal grants now start to become funding certified, which is the next phase in July and August. Because many of the states, just like us last year, will have a special bonding and an opportunity for us to be able to get bonded. In either case, they have to process the final grants within 60 days so that they could clear their books of their fiscal year. And then the conditional awards are signed and start 180 days from the date of that signature being awarded. And then in September to January is when they will actually list next year's priority list and identify the people that have been, by that time we hope that the secretary has signed off on his conditional awards, and that will allow us then to start billing against that $54 million. Next slide. These slides are some scenarios that we worked up as we looked at what options may end up out on the table for us. Certainly, if we get funded in bonding $54.1 million, we're guaranteed the completion of the phase three. We will continue to work through to try to get the 54 or 65% from the federal government. And whatever it is that they may be able to supply to us, it's sometimes if the money is not 65% like it was a couple of years ago, they will give us what they have available. Phase two and three can continue as scheduled that way, and it mitigates some risks for the residents. We can go and continue to look for CMS certification on all of the buildings, which is a revenue stream that this committee had asked us to look at as well as the governor. Quality of life, while I realize that may not be a lot, in some estimation, the quality of life is really important for these residents that they all be and their families, that everybody has the same quality of life on this campus. And we'll be able to reduce, in this particular case, the Minneapolis wait list by 100 people, 100 beds. Our worst scenario is that phase three be funded at 35% or not at all. Then we need to look at what the cost of constructions in the future would be if we don't have the money 65% from the feds. And if it's not obtainable, if we're never going to build 17 South, then we have to really look and decide whether what we're going to do with the $33 million project of Phase 2, because there are some significant impacts as a result of infrastructure having been pushed all down to Phase 3. That pretty much, there are some other arguments that I'm not going to.
We'll probably get into some of them with the questions. Maybe we'll go to questions now. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is just a question generally. You just touched on having about 100 folks, or if the project would move forward, moving about 100 people off the waiting list. Obviously, there's communities that are not served by a Veterans Hospital. How are veterans currently served in a system that obviously doesn't have room for all veterans that need the services?
Who's the Mr. Gallucci, or who wants to handle that one?
I got that. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, thank you for your question. Veterans are served now a variety of ways. Some of them are in regular nursing long-term care. Some of them stay home. It's a cost issue for many of them. The benefit of a veteran's home for us is that, for instance, the protection of it becomes a cost issue for the veteran and his family or her family. And so, for instance, their estate planning changes. If they come to me, they have a one-day look back. If they go to a private facility that does not get VA per diem, and they rely on Medicaid, Medicare, then they will have a five-year look back to their estate. And so that drives and keeps a lot of people home, or there is an enormous cost to the family overall. So in areas where they're not currently with a VA hospital or a VA home, then those are their only options.
Alexis Stravinsky and members, there's a letter in your packet that tries to address that question. On our Veterans Day here at the Capitol, because I live in Ramsey County, I was visited by our veterans person from Ramsey County. And as she talked about what she does in her work life, it was exactly addressing the question you asked, what happens on a local level? And I had actually asked her to come today to give that other perspective, but her letter is here, and she describes her position as Director of Ramsey County Veterans Services. I spend a great deal of time working with the veterans of Ramsey County and the family and friends who are advocating for them as they attempt to transition from living in their homes to living in settings where more assistance is provided. The most common situation involves an elderly veteran or their spouse who encounter a significant medical issue or is suffering from memory loss as a result of dementia or Alzheimer's. Often in a very short time and without warning, families are faced with quickly finding a supported living situation for their loved one. And then she describes the veteran's home in Minneapolis has an 8 to 12 month wait, so obviously that is not an immediate solution. And so the other services she hopes are available are in-home care, senior housing, assisted living, memory care, skilled nursing options, all supported living options add a financial burden to the household that many veterans and widows are unprepared to absorb. And in the last paragraph, talks about the pressing issue for supported housing for veterans who are transitioning from homelessness. And so I think what we are, every single person sitting around these tables, every single person I know wants safe housing and accessible immediate housing for every veteran. That would be our goal. And what we have to try to figure out is how do we get there? Because clearly we're not there now with the waiting list. I thought I would just mention the number of bills in our possession. I think you've heard them. There is a request for veterans home funding in Montevideo, in Brainerd, in Bemidji. Those bills have come to us at least for four years, and we haven't moved forward. There is another one for a Northern Minnesota veterans home. There is a Norton bill for a veterans a home in Rochester, Beltrami County. And so we continue to have vast numbers of legislators who address this. But I think the question that we ultimately have to do when we step back is say, why aren't we solving it, and what's the path? And, of course, we're caught in a situation where it's not necessarily we're not setting the rules. I mean, there's rules are being set here in Washington, that and we operate in that arena, but there is the feeling that we're not on a state level, that we're not making progress. I think we're hearing from people, too, that some veterans would prefer to stay, to live in their homes as long as possible, and if we had living at home block nurse or whatever in the community, that would enable them to stay in their homes. Some of them would perhaps prefer to stay in their nursing home, in their community near family and friends. Some of that is not possible because of the of some of the again the federal rules applied. And I think what we're hearing from all these bills is a strong desire to have smaller veterans' homes all over the state. Closer to perhaps where they live and families are. So the huge frustration I have is this sense that it's a problem we're really not solving. And you know, can a state step back and say, we're going to approach it differently in a way that gets us to 100% housing instead of year-long wait. So, anyway, I'm sorry, that was a longer. Representative Swedzinski, back to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You kind of touched on something. You talked about solving the problem. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see, even if we went forward and bonded for every single one of these community facilities for veterans care across the state that are being proposed, what percentage of the total population actually being served by those projects? So we're talking about solving the problem, talking about, 100% of potential people that would be in these homes. You know, how would that process work, and what kind of numbers are we really looking at? Look, are we serving 2%, 5% of the total population? I mean, with current projects, you know, if we're talking about solving the issue, and what kind of dollars are we going to have to spend to get all the way to that 100%? What's that total cost goal? What do you think that... there you go.
Mr. Gallucci.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. If I had that answer, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair right here.
I thought that probably was going to be the answer.
I would say to you, though, that we currently have wait lists in the state of Minnesota at 874. The aspect and the things that I've asked the communities that have approached me since my coming on board that wish to have a home was, what are you looking for? What is the population that you have in your area that you're going to serve? I couldn't answer that question for them. We're working through some technical things to be able to load up in veteran information, but at the end of the day, I'm not so certain that I can give you that total. We would have to build 10 homes right now for 100% to take care of the waiting list that's standing around. I don't think that's going to be something that happens. But to your question and to your point earlier, Madam Chair, what that has forced us to do is look at new ways to partner with the VA. How can we assist in places where somebody wishes to stay at home or be in an assisted living that doesn't necessarily at this moment in time need to be in a skilled nursing facility? How can I assist that, and how can we somehow work through that? So we're in the discussions currently with the VA last month. I went to D.C. to have this conversation, and we're working with the VISN 23, which takes and oversees all of the homes here in the Minnesota in the state, about other ways that we could perhaps deliver services closer to them through telemedicine, telehealth, maintain our operating costs a little less, increase the ability of staying closer towards your home or in your home until such time as it becomes an absolute necessity for you to go into skilled nursing. And those are the kinds of things. I wish I could have that 100% answer for you, Representative, but it's very difficult for me to put a number to that.
Further question, Representative Kuczynski? Were you finished?
It looked like he wanted to say something.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. I guess to help out a little bit better, what we do know is there's in the neighborhood of 370,000 veterans in the state, and 44% of those are age 65 or older. We don't know how many of those elderly veterans, and realize in the veterans' homes, it's not all just elderly residents. It's residents that have other issues as well, and the domiciliaries and so forth. But we don't know how many of those veterans are actually going to desire to go into a veterans' home or require to go into a veterans' home. So I just wanted to pitch out some of those numbers to you to assist you a little bit.
Further? Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a brief comment, you know, I take a look at, I have a few veterans' bills that I'm carrying myself, a few, but I think if you really take a look at a country, a nation, and a state, you know, how you can really judge a character of a state is how well we take care of our men and women who have served over the years. And question regarding, you mentioned a waiting list, and also Commissioner Shelato is here today. He's up in the, I'd like to welcome him to our committee. How many people do you have on the waiting list? How many veterans are actually waiting? I know you mentioned you had 914 total beds statewide. How many are actually on the waiting list, and are all these beds filled?
I heard 874, right?
We have a list of 874, and if I might, Madam Chair, Representative Dittmer, the 916 beds would be once we fully construct and occupy 17 South. So if you take 100 beds off from that, currently we have about 840 beds out there in the world. And everybody is at 100% except at my domiciliary in Hastings, which is averaging about 170 beds of the potential 200 that they have licensed for. I would also like to point out to the committee that, again, the cap that we have from the VA is 1,058. So even if we wanted to complete all of the wait list that currently is standing, we would have to go back to D.C. and we would have to submit for an application to raise our cap of beds, because that's obviously tied to their operating dollars of per diem. And we would have to give justification for why we would want to do that.
And just and maybe another comment for the committee. How many here have actually visited one of our veterans' homes? Okay, there you go. And I think it's important that when you're visiting the veterans' homes, you also notice that there's veterans have family members there that want to come and visit. And I know having a facility where families are welcomed and can be part of the care that has taken place for our veterans is very important, too. So thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You say you've had 874 veterans looking for a bed. Just out of curiosity, how many beds in nursing homes throughout the state are decommissioned, so to speak? They no longer are able to put people in there because they can't afford to keep that bed there.
I don't know if I have. Thank you.
Mr.
I apologize. I'm trying to remember the quorum. First time before you, so I appreciate your patience with me. Representative, to answer your question, one of the issues that we looked at was understanding what the population of veterans home, skilled nursing homes are here within the state, and how many have closed because they couldn't keep their doors open, and what does that do? Because that's obviously a scenario that if we started putting veterans into private homes or private nursing homes, what would happen if they had to close their doors? Over the last 2 years, there has been 48 nursing home closures across the state of Minnesota of the 410, I believe it was, that this report out of the university showed. And so, to your point, I think that I don't know how many veterans are actually in those homes, that could come to us. Many of them are already registered on the wait list, waiting to come to us. But because of dynamics within their home life, they needed to go to a skilled nursing right away. So hopefully I answered your question.
You answered a question, but not mine.
Okay, I'll try again.
Okay. The question I have is, like, in a nursing home very close to where I live, they have 29 beds they no longer can have people go to because they can't afford to have those open. Now, I don't know what they call that exactly, but I, being a good Navy man, I call it decommissioned. But I think the thing I'm getting at with all these things, the reason that's the first step before they go broke is when they start there and give their inventory away. So is there any way that we can tie your desire to have more people in beds and mine with their desire to have those beds opened again?
And I think, Representative Gunther, we might have to bring some other people in, but I mean, I do think that's at the heart of a discussion that we have to have, and whether it happens, I don't know if it happens in your committee or here, but I think everyone feels that is a direction. I mean, we have simply got to look in that direction. So I think I'm going to suggest that you just raised the frame of another hearing that we might have where we bring some additional people in to answer that question.
If I may?
Yes. We've got another issue, and so I have just two more questions I want to get in, and then maybe you can make some concluding remarks. Representative Dean and Representative Ward, and then we're going to have to, I think, conclude this.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Glucci, I was just wondering if you could talk for a little bit about how the federal funding works with waivered services for folks who want to receive services in their home. That veterans are like everybody else, that they would probably like to stay in their homes as long as possible. And from a statewide perspective, in fact, our state policy is to provide community and supportive services in the home as long as possible. It's what people want, and it's, in fact, cheaper. How does the federal funding work with being able to provide waivered services to folks who want to stay in their homes, and how is that affected by the bed cap that we receive federally?
Mr. Village.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, thank you for your question. I answer the last part first, and that is that I'm not sure that that it affects the bed cap of what we have. With that said, I do know that the VA itself, the federal VA, provides some in-house nurse visiting rotations. They do that in a number of ways. They're trying to expand that through their CBOC program, that the community-based outreach centers as well. But what that doesn't provide is a per diem for the individuals, and doesn't provide a per diem approval that will go to Representative Gunther's question of beds that are in nursing homes that have been decommissioned. So I'm thinking at this stage the VA has not opened up the door for state veterans homes to have visiting nurses make circuits and be able to obtain their per diem rate. And that's an issue that we can look into further.
I think your question too, I think, I mean, I don't know how we're going to get at this, but I mean, this is clearly a challenge that we haven't quite arrived at an answer yet, and I think the last two questions. Representative Ward gets the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Glucci and Mr. McKinley, first of all, veterans, the reason for veterans nursing homes is because veterans, as I have found, want to stay together. They want to be together. They want to be together towards their end of life. And then Representative Detmer, you also said that family is near them, is very important for veterans as well. So as we were trying to put our proposal together, there's some things that are included with a veteran also about asset buy down and things as such that are favorable for them as well, and rightfully so. But I want to go back to Representative Gunther and Representative Dean's point, and Mr. Glucci, you touched on it a little bit. When you went to D.C., when we were putting our proposal together, we had the same thing, Representative Gunther, that we had some nursing homes that had some availability, had some space, decommissioned beds. And so we started asking that question, why can't we set a wing aside? Because veterans want to stay together. They want to be in a block together. Why can't we designate a wing in a private nursing home? And what we found was that, you know, the MA wouldn't be allowed to follow them at that point. In fact, it needs a federal legislation change. And so I'm going to encourage Commissioner and the department to pursue that. I know Senator Franken had, when we were looking at our proposal, had talked to us about trying to do just that, put together a waiver proposal to allow the MA to follow in a private nursing home if they had a separate wing. And, you know, one of the proposals that the feds are looking at are like what are called like greenhouse kind of plans, you know, where you have a central location and then wings off to the side of that. And so a lot of nursing homes have that same kind of layout at this point. So it would work very well with current nursing homes in a large part of the state. So I want to encourage the department to pursue that hard and heavy. Senator Franken has heard this, knows the concern, but the whole federal delegation needs to hear the concern with the veterans in the state of Minnesota as we look at 800-plus veterans needing that. So it takes a change of federal law, and I would hope that we get there sometime in the near future.
So I think all of that is kind of concluding comment, and I think there's huge motivation around this table, and I know from Representative Murphy as well, to get to the point of 100% safe housing. And maybe we'll touch base with some of the people who've asked questions, and then really some of the DHS folks too, to say how do we get to a point where next year we're feeling a little better about where we are. But thank you so much for your presentation today, and obviously this is one of those areas where I think we all feel we haven't quite reached a point of clarity. Yeah.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for your time, committee.
And then we'll ask Representative Winkler, Representative Fisher. Yes, yeah. But we'll ask them to come to the table. And Ms. Dyson, did you want to just give us a little history before they address their specific bills?
Madam Chair, it's up to your wish. If you, I understood that you wanted me to explain why these bills are in this committee.
We'll start there, and then we'll have them address their.
The reason that these two bills, House File 833 and 592, are in the Capital Investment Committee have to do with the fact that they are both dealing with the transfer of state bond finance property. Representative Fisher's bill, 833, is transferring the Harambe Community School to the Roseville School District, and 592 is authorizing the I think it's East Metropolitan Integration District to transfer the Crosswind School in Woodbury to the Purpich Center for Arts Education. As I said, both of these properties are state bond finance properties, and that means that to transfer ownership of them or to change the use of the properties, the property has to be either determined to be no longer state bond finance property, or the legislature has to authorize the change in ownership or use in the same manner in which the appropriation of bond proceeds is made, which means 3/5 vote of the of each body and originating in the House. To determine that property is no longer state bond finance property, there are two ways to do that. One is that the property is determined by the state agency to which the bonds were appropriated in these two cases, the Department of Education, that the properties are no longer needed for the purposes for which bonds were appropriated, and then the properties are sold for at fair market value. And that effectively cleanses the title of the limitations on state bond finance property. The other option is that if the property is older than 125% of the estimated useful life of the improved property, the improvements made with state GO bonds, the owner can work with the state agency, Minnesota Management and Budget, and the Attorney General's office as bond counsel to remove the designation of state bond financing from the property title. In determining, so if neither of those are happening, in determining if the property is, well, the other thing I wanted to say is, in determining that property is no longer state bond financed property, whether the bonds that were used for the acquisition improvements have been repaid is really not relevant. State bond financed property remains so until the title is cleansed. This is to ensure that the intent of the Constitution is followed. Both bond proceed recipients are not just fiscal agents, as they might be in appropriations of general fund money. The appropriation to an eligible entity is not used to just transfer the property to an ineligible entity or to an entity that the legislature didn't contemplate when enacting the original bond appropriation, or for a purpose that's not eligible. The Constitution requires specificity. You have to name the entity and the purpose for which the bond proceeds are appropriated, or you have to appropriate it to a statutory program. The question is always whether the substance of the transaction desired was contemplated in what the legislature enacted. And if there's any doubt whether if it would be completely, the standard bond counsel used in reviewing this is, would it be completely unreasonable for a court to determine otherwise? So if there's any doubt that the provision, then the legislature has to amend the provisions either directly or, as in the case of these two bills, by specific reference to the original bond appropriation. And then it has to be passed in the same manner as an appropriation of bond proceeds, three-fifths vote of each body and originating the House. And I guess the last thing I wanted to say is that this is not new. In the members that have worked on bond bills in the past will remember the provisions in the Omnibus Capital Investment Bill that I always refer to as the back of the bill stuff. They are the amendments to prior bond appropriations to either change the grantee or modify the purpose. You've seen the appropriation that originally went to the city of Blue Earth for some purpose, and it turned out it was the EDA that owned the property. So we had to amend the bond appropriation to have it go to the EDA. We've had to amend bills to add the word pre-design, otherwise the money could not be used for pre-design. When Hennepin County and the City of Minneapolis libraries were merged, the original appropriation to Minneapolis for the planetarium, that appropriation had to be amended so that it went to Hennepin County. Minneapolis couldn't just hand over the money to Hennepin County. So those are the kinds of examples and why the bills are in front of this committee.
So I asked her to do that just so that members would understand, because we have a lot of new members on this committee, why these two bills are before us. And Representative Winkler, should we have you go first, or who would like to? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for having the hearing. And I'd also like to thank Ms. Dyson for providing some guidance to us as we have struggled to figure out what kind of legislation, what kind of action needs to take place here. Just a brief history. 11 school districts in the East Metro area got together and formed the East Metro Integration District, EMID. One of the schools, Representative Fisher will talk about the other one, but one of the schools that they put together is called Crosswinds. It's a middle school that is based on the premise that through arts and science you can get kids from a broad diversity of backgrounds together and that can succeed together. You have, I think, at least it was over here, a packet of testimony from families at the Crosswind School and possibly from the other school, I'm not sure, strongly in support of the Crosswinds school. They're very happy with it, and they can share really powerful testimony. They don't need to do that today, but powerful testimony about how the school has changed their children's lives.
Isn't your packet in the behind the bill? The reference he's making is a group of letters.
And so, now the EMID is winding down its operations and closing two schools. The EMID board requested proposals from people about what to they, you know, from organizations or entities to use the building or continue the programs at Crosswinds. Two proposals came back. One was from the Perpich Center for Arts Education to continue the Crossman School essentially with its current mission and purpose, which is pretty consistent with what the Purpose Center does. The other proposal came from the South Washington School District, and I believe their purpose is to use the building for a school district purpose. So those two proposals came back. The EMED board voted to support the Purpose proposal and put an April 1 deadline on the legislation needing to pass in order to make that possible. Since that time, we have learned through Ms. Dyson that if we want to transfer the building at all, whether it continues its current programming with Purpose or whether it goes to South Washington, a bill has to be passed by the legislature with a 3/5 vote. Otherwise, essentially, the building will have to be put up for sale because there's no other intention of continuing its operation or its use. So that's the situation we face. I represent the district in which Purpose is located. I just would like to say that the Purpose operation of Crosswinds is not something that is specifically for Golden Valley or the West Metro. It really has the purpose of an arts and science-based education with a premise that you can bring kids together from diverse backgrounds and they can succeed, and this would continue that operation for which state bond funds were originally appropriated. So that's where it comes from, and I really appreciate your time this morning.
And then we'll have Representative Fisher, and then we'll invite the superintendent. I think you have additional testimony to your bill.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. Very quickly, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today with this bill before you. You'll find some information that's being passed around from the superintendent to address the area. Basically, it comes back, this is collaboration with a very unique way to address some of the education issues that we had in the back. And I was very fortunate that when the school system first came together, my children were part of the first classes that came through there. I was part of the people that originally came down for lobbying to the legislature here for the Crosswinds bill. This is a great, unique initiative. We've got people who are committed to wanting to keep this great vision alive, and I think it's important for us as the legislature to make sure that we continue the vision that was originally started years ago. It has evolved. I think it's going to be getting better as we go down the road, but we just need some permission from the legislature to take care of some technical details so that we're going to be able to address this to keep moving it forward. And at that point in time, I do have the Superintendent Tyne here for any questions.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. If there, you could just pull another chair from the table or the Superintendent of the Roseville Schools, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Tyne. I serve as Superintendent for Roseville Area Schools District 623. Thank you for the committee for allowing me to speak today concerning the transfer of property. You have a leave behind at your desk that is a brief overview of the rationale for the transfer. And basically what we're requesting as part of your action would be the transfer of ownership, management, and operation of Arambe Community School to District 623, as outlined in Bill 833. I'm going to make my presentation brief because I know your timeline is short. There are a number of reasons for this. The main reason happens to deal with the students and the families of Arambe. Right now, they are very positive about the education that they're receiving at Arambe. But because the school is closing and the board has made that decision, Roseville is very willing and excited to step in and to continue the programs for the students and family. The other reason is for the programs that are offered and also the integration that takes place right now. It's a very diverse learning community where we have students from 8 different local districts that work and learn together. And the main reason, it's located within our district boundaries. And we would like to see this school continue to operate. We think it's good for our community. It's good for our families. It is a year-round option that is unique to the suburban area. And we'd like to protect the asset. And really, it is a state asset. It is a community asset. And we know that if Roseville is involved and we offer it as a school, which was the original intent, we know that program will continue well into the future. And it's our intent to do that, to continue the integration program, to continue the academic program that's in place. And I'll stop there, and I'll leave behind and stand for any questions.
And members, we do actually, are these author's amendments that are in our packets? Right. Just so that the bills are before us in the form that you want, though we're not moving on the bills today, I think we would officially attach your amendment. So first of all, I would move on House File 592. The amendment is A4. Representative Winkler, do you want to speak to the...
Madam Chair, members, the A4 amendment essentially is the language recommended by Ms. Dyson to ensure that the transfer to purpose is included in the House File 592 according to state bond guidelines.
Technical to respond to her. So any questions to that? This is just to get the bill before us as counsel has advised. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment is...
Thanks for that strong vote.
And then the other one, House File 833. Representative Fisher, is that the same issue, the A3 amendment?
Yes, Chair Houseman, it is.
Okay. Questions about that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Well, how about that? It's been transformed. Those opposed? That amendment is adopted. And so those, that just gets the bills before us. So further testimony from any of the three before we move to questions. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question may get directed to Ms. Dyson, but just kind of looking at some of the press, are we setting some new precedent here with the idea of transferring a school like this, kind of operating, especially within the parameters of the age and, know, what the Purpose Center does, and then what I'm kind of understanding here is that the local districts that currently are operating the school are no longer going to do this, and this is an opportunity for the school to continue operating because the folks that are already doing it don't want to do it anymore. Am I kind of getting the baseline of that done?
Who would like to?
Madam Chair, Representative Swidzinski, I think from a precedent standpoint, as Ms. Dyson mentioned, we make adjustments to bond mm-hmm. appropriations all the time. In fact, I could give examples in my own district where we have done that. So I don't think that is new. We do have a unique situation here, at least in my experience, where the state has made a commitment in the past to a particular model of integration education in a geographic area, and the local folks who have been maintaining that model are interested in going in a different direction, and there is a willing state partner who's willing to step forward and continue the operations and continue that model that we've already made a commitment to. So from my point of view, this is a state commitment and a state asset and a program that we think is worthwhile, and we're allowing an agency to continue its operations, and it was strongly supported in the education committees.
Okay.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, that was going to be my next question, just kind of what the feedback was from the Ed Committee and some of those things and that had visited there. So, sounds good. Thanks.
So both of these bills were heard in the Education Committee, and they have forwarded them here. Representative Ms. Dyson, did you have any further relative to the precedent issue?
No.
The misunderstanding, I think, which I think I would just state for the record, was that the board... that was the governing board to the school, I think initially, not knowing the background that Ms. Dyson talked about, thought that they had the opportunity to just transfer. And initially, their actions said they were giving the Purpich speaker a deadline by which to receive this legislative approval for the assumption of the program, the management of the program. And I think that deadline was April 1st. MMB informed that board that they really don't have, and then I think it was automatically going to revert to South Washington County, and MMB then conveyed to that board that they wouldn't have that authority. They couldn't just on their own make the determination about where that property would go. And to Representative Swidzinski's question, that would have been precedent, and so I think that's why we have the. We have the bill here. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who can answer this, but this weekend I did read the Office of the Legislative Audit report regarding the Purpich Center. Do you want to make any comments about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, there are folks here from the Purpose Center if you would like them to come up, but the report was done, I think, last summer or spring, and there were a few small technical findings, but the Purpose Center a number of years ago had some significant accounting challenges. They have gone through a leadership transition, and I think you'll see a difference, an enormous difference, between the prior audit and the current audit that's in place. And I have, frankly, a very great deal of confidence in their leadership and the financial integrity of the Purpose Center. They're very convinced that they can operate this well, and I think the legislative auditor's findings indicate that they can be trusted in that way.
Okay, thank you.
And so there had been a leadership change after some of those findings. Representative Detmer, they are here if you want to pursue that, but...
I'm going to get on that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be to the superintendent, Mr. Thien?
Tyne.
I'm looking at the handout, Leave Behind, and in the second paragraph, the first sentence, it says, due to financial constraints, forced to close. I'm just wondering, I have a couple questions with some statements in this that I'd like for you to respond to, and that the first one would be, what type of financial constraints are we dealing with here?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Tyne, I don't know if you're in a position or if we have somebody else in the room who can speak to that. But
I think I might be able to address that. I have a long history with the East Metro Integration District. The East Metro Integration District is a collaborative of 10 school districts that ran Harambe and Crosswinds together. Because of the way the funding was set up through integration, Harambe and Crosswinds were not financially feasible for the East Metro Integration District. Now, I assume the next question is, if it's not feasible for them, why is it feasible for you? And one of the reasons is because the students that attend Harambe from our district will generate referendum dollars. That was not possible through the East Metro Integration District. Also, there are some additional dollars that would flow. Example would be transportation is one where the East Metro District did not receive it. Roseville Area Schools would when they operate the district. Also, administratively and some indirect costs, since we have those things in place already, we're able to provide those services without adding them. So I hope that addresses partially your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The next paragraph, then, it also talks about a bit of a warning. It says possibility of attending a traditional school in unfamiliar surroundings would be a hardship for the majority of the families. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that point.
Madam Chair? Yes, I could. The students that attend Harambe come from 8 different districts. Many of them have been there from preschool on to 5th grade. Right now, if that school closed, those students would have to matriculate or move back to their home districts, many of them who have never attended schools there before. So it would be some sort of a hardship. It would be a transfer of a student. You've attended an elementary school for 5 years, and all of a sudden you pick up and say, well, I have to go back to a school within my home district. And it's not that it would be a total hardship that they would be in danger, but it would be a change in their academic career. And many of the parents are very concerned about that.
Madam Chair,
Representative
Albright, I'd also add that in the education committees, we had, as I mentioned, very compelling testimony from a lot of the parents involved at Crosswinds, and I imagine the same thing is true at Harambe.
Yes.
Talk about what a major difference this made in their children's lives. These are kids, in many cases, who do much better in these. These are kids, in many cases, who do much better in these environments than in the traditional school environment. And I've heard parents say that this was life-saving for their kids. And there are members of the legislature who can, Representative Freiberg and others that I can think of, who have family members there and will testify to the big impact these schools have had on these kids. And so, you know, that's not, I guess I have assumed that's not kind of the intention of this committee to hear all of that, but the testimony was very powerful.
Dr. Fine.
I could add one more thing, too. Those are year-round options, both Crosswinds and Harambe, where those options are not available in the local districts. So students and families who are exposed to a year-round option and have attended a year-round option all of a sudden go back to a traditional school calendar. And in many cases, that does cause problems and hardships for families in daycare, et cetera, jobs, careers.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess based upon that, those comments, what would be a typical description or point of reference for a student that would be attending Harambe? Where are they? Are they coming from a geographic area that where they're not familiar with language? They're not familiar with. Are we learning? Are we dealing with learning disciplines? With learning difficulties? Are we? What's the concern of matriculation in back into their home district? Is it? Why are they drawn to Harambe as opposed to wanting to attend? And I understand about the referendum dottos and that type of thing, but why is there such a distinctive advantage, no derogatory sentiment made, to attract them to Harambe versus a home district school?
I'm sure. Year-round is a big draw. The environmental science, plus a number of the students who attended and families who attend come from communities where there's less diversity. They may be a student of color who in their home district probably would feel that there's not a critical mass of students that look like them or staff that looks like them. Harambe offers that to those families and to that community. So those are three of the main reasons. The year-round, I would say, is probably the main drawing point, but also the diversity of the students who attend Harambe and, I assume, Crosswinds. I know Crosswinds.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, for Ms. Dyson, so if we fail to act and fail to act with 60% majority, do the school, in, whether they go to Purpert Center and to Roseville School District or elsewhere, do these schools simply close then? Is that the outcome if we fail to take action that has 60% support?
Ms. Dyson.
To the extent you know.
excuse me, Madam Chair and Representative Atkins, I don't know if they close, but they don't transfer. The ownership of the property remains with the East Metro Integration District, and the district may then have the options they have then at that point are, you know, continue operating, close it, or put it up for fair market value sale because it's no longer needed for the purposes for which they had the bond proceeds appropriated.
But if it's a fair market sale, the state has an interest in that.
Under the statute, if the buildings are sold under the statute, the proceeds of the sale first dibs on the money goes to the state to pay any bonds that are outstanding, and then the statute lays out the distribution of any additional proceeds of that sale, and so if there are additional proceeds in. If the bonds have already been totally repaid, then I don't remember. I'd have to look it up what happens to the money. But that would effectively cleanse title of the properties so that they would no longer be deemed state bond finance property.
Okay. And then, and Madam Chair, and to the authors, and is there a consensus now among the participating school districts about how this should be? And particularly Harambe, I haven't heard any opposition to that. Originally, I heard considerable opposition among some of the participating school districts to the Crosswinds being transferred to the Purpert Center. Has that been taken care of at this point?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, the answer is no. Although I'm not sure that it's, I think there's disagreement, but I would not say that the districts all have concluded what the best option is. I think the Senate likely will take a little different approach than the House will, on particularly on Crosswinds. I have heard that the Senate may introduce a bill, to do this same thing, but to transfer the ownership to the South Washington School District. And so, like it or not, we're in a situation where this decision will, to your point, will be made at the Capitol of whether or not this is just shuts down and the buildings are mothballed, whether they're sold on the market, or whether the East Metro Integration District, for some, I don't know how, but would in some way would continue and the constituent school districts would continue to support the existence of these schools as is. But if they want to get move the buildings, the legislature is going to be involved.
And just one brief follow-up, and that is, what's the argument, Representative Winkler, for the South Washington School District taking ownership of it? Is that the other potential option, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, I think I obviously can't speak for them, and we don't share the same opinion on this issue, but I think their argument would be that they're one of the participating school districts. The Roseville School District is going to be taking on the continued operations of Harambe, and so in an analogous situation, South Washington should be able to take over use of this building. I think, to my knowledge, and I could be, you know, I could be corrected and happily so, but to my knowledge, South Washington does not intend to continue operation of Crosswinds under the current model. They intend to use the building for a different purpose. So in that way, I'd say it's different from the Roseville example with Harambe.
So these two bills are the only ones moving through the House, and as far as I know, there wasn't a bill introduced about the South Washington County, and that may have been a misunderstanding that any conveyance would require state action. And so I think maybe there's been some confusion about that too. But, did you have any follow-up?
No, that's a good starting point.
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a couple of questions, and I think some of it's been alluded to, but just to clarify it in my mind, has there been public comment period for both of these projects, and that would be both for the existing school and the one that's going to take over control?
Representative Fisher?
Yes, there has been. This has all been heard in the Education Committee, and there was quite a bit of testimony for both on both bills as they came through.
But my question is now, like, if we do levies or referendums and stuff for our schools, there has to be printed in the paper that there will be public meetings held out in the districts for the people in that district. Have you had those meetings?
Yes, I can answer that. There have been public hearings by the EMID school board on the closure of the schools.
Representative Winkler, further to that? Representative Green.
What about the comment period for the school district that will, or even the Purpose Center, you know, about the people that are going to be taking over the school?
Representative Winkler, of course, the Purpose Center is the level of state agency, so wouldn't be governed in the same way as, for example, a local school district, I think, to that point.
Well, Madam Chair, the Purpose Center has the distinction of being both a state agency and a school district. But the meetings of all of these organizations are public, and I'm not sure that the levy referendum rules would apply to this situation. I know that the EMID school board has had multiple public meetings about this. There are people who are very energized on various sides on this issue and have been participating. So there's been significant public comment. And on the Purpose side, I think most of that public discussion has taken place at the EMID school board rather than at the Purpose Center board meetings.
Okay. Okay. Then just one last question, I guess, and a comment too. So what you're saying is that the Roseville School District hasn't had any meetings on it yet, but then if this gets transferred over to the Purpose Center, that will eliminate any public input to what goes on in those schools, as far as what the people in the area would have to say about it.
Dr. Fine.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there has. It's been addressed at our school board meetings. It's been addressed a number of times. And also, we have a school board member that serves on the EMID board, too. Each district has a representative on it. It's been in our newspaper. It's been addressed in our local publications that go to every household. All of our meetings are televised also. So there has been public input. In fact, on this particular project for the transfer of Harambe, there has been considerable support from member districts, EMID districts, from our local residents, and unanimous from the EMID board and the Roseville board.
And, Madam Chair, just to clarify, of course, the public meeting laws and all of the other public input requirements for a school district apply to the Purpose Center. And, you know, I don't know I would imagine that if they're going to be taking up issues related to crosswinds, that they probably are not just going to have their meetings solely at their facility in Golden Valley. They're probably going to be spending a fair amount of time in the East Metro District having public hearings as well. So it's absolutely not the case that there will not be an opportunity for local folks and the school people involved in the schools to be involved in Purpose Center meetings as well. That will certainly be the case.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Malley.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my question is maybe for Ms. Dyson, or maybe, Madam Chair, you can explain it. But I thought that we didn't bond for K through 12 schools. I know Red Lake is one example that I've heard before where we've bonded for. But from my understanding, every other school in the state, including very property poor districts, have to pass a levy or referendum in order to cover construction costs. So I'm just wondering how it came about that we introduced a $20 million bond for a charter school. Have we done that for other charter schools? And why is it that this exception was made when we normally don't do state bonding for K through 12 schools?
Ms. Dyson? We'll see.
Madam Chair and Representative Malley, I can't give you the history of how this came about. It is a special kind of district, and so the East Metro Integration District, and there was a period of time in the 1990s when this program was set up to set up schools like this. I don't know if they're charter schools. I don't know education. I'm hearing no. This is not a charter school thing. But there is also the Maximum Effort School Loan Program, and the legislature has issued state GO bonds for that program for many years, and again, I don't have the details of that program, but they are loans, but in some instances, they end up effectively being forgiven. So I would say it is that there are special purposes that the legislature has decided it is appropriate to issue GO bonds for school districts' facilities. I'll stop there because we don't have standing programs. It's not every time, but the legislature has done it.
And I was just consulting with my committee administrator for some we were not remembering. I think this predates us, the decision about this school and why it was bonded for. So we might have to do a little more background and get it to members of the committee. Mid-90s.
So Madam Chair or Ms. Dyson, so if my district schools had big construction needs, could I introduce a bonding bill in order to get them state bonds for those construction needs?
I wasn't here. My guess is, and maybe some of you know the history, Dr. Thine, that it was simply because a number of districts were proposing a new model. Dr. Thine?
Usually they look to the oldest person in the room, so thank you. As a person who was there from the beginning of this, when the East Metro Integration District was put together, there were two districts that were involved. It was Roseville and St. Paul. And later on, North St. Paul Maplewood was added. As the integration and desegregation rules and funding changed over a period of time, it was decided that they needed a separate site for elementary school. And at that time, it was called the Tri-District Schools. It was passed under a magnet school grant and through the bonding process. Crosswinds followed it about 3 or 4 years later, and it was built in a similar manner through state funding. And it was for integration purposes, and the districts, 10 districts, were put together. It's the same thing on the west side with WEMEP, which operates a couple of schools too, and have received funding for that. It was at that time a special legislation that brought that about.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I guess I'm just wondering, because it seems to me a lot of districts around the state, like St. Louis County School District, for example, they consolidated a lot of their schools because in the long run it will save money. It's a very rural district, but had some very costly construction costs, and because of that they have 19 teachers on the chopping block right now. So it just seems to me that I've always been told we don't do bonding projects for schools. So I just wanted to know the history of why in this case we did. And I know Red Lake is one other example that we've done it for, but I just think it's, unfortunate if we do it for some and not others. I mean, my opinion, it should be all or nothing.
Members, just because... Representative
Moline. No, I was just going to say, Madam Chair, that maybe Representative Moline should create a Cuyuna-Mesabi Range Integration District so both ranges can get to know each other better, and they can use that as a basis for magnet school.
But to your point, I think we'll try to get some... I don't know if there's a briefing paper on it, but we do very rarely any bonding for K-12, and we'll see if we can put together a little bit of past history, so because it might guide us here. Representative Swedzinski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just my last question, I promise. To the authors, just, you know, it seems that there is potential for a little contention with this bill. If it wasn't able to move forward, you know, looking at just the really unique needs of these students, it seems like they've got some different demands and for what it be in curriculum or just the school year in general. I mean, do you think there's any appetite, you know, maybe to create a scholarship program for those individual students to help allow them to really follow a curriculum that best fits their needs, you know, that maybe the money follows those students to integrate in the way that they want to integrate, or any number of other things? Do you think there'd be much appetite for that among you guys as authors or anything like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, the problem is that it wouldn't really solve the issue of what to do with these facilities, because they still either have to be sold on the market or they have to continue their programming. And it seems to me if you've got a successful operation, better to keep that and the kids want to stay going there and the families want to continue, it would be better to continue that operation rather than to not solve the problem of the building and create a scholarship program for them.
Okay. So thanks. For our perspective, we're really only interested in the conveyance because we got an unusual situation with facility. Representative Dean, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Winkler, this the Purpich Center is in a very unique situation. And I have to admit that I've never been there, and I've just figured out that I have not thinking about it. I don't know why I haven't, but I just haven't been over there, so I'll have to take you up on the invitation you're going to give me to give me a tour.
I was just going to say you can come up to my office and look at the art, Representative Dean. I wasn't going to invite you to my district.
You'll come back, I warn you.
Just kidding.
They'll be for the floor. I was just... are there other facilities outside the footprint of the Purpich Center that are currently under the management of the Purpich Center that you know of?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, the Purpich Center doesn't have physical facilities outside, but the reach of the Purpich Center is actually statewide because in addition to taking kids from all over the state, they also do the curriculum development and professional development for arts education statewide. In addition, Representative Erdahl has given them legacy funds in the past for bringing arts curriculum and arts and science curriculum to districts all over the state. So they have a statewide mission. And so while they don't operate a different facility, this is consistent with what they've done. And in fact, Purpich intends to use this middle school integration in art and science program as a means of developing better curriculum for arts education statewide as well. So it fits with their mission and purpose, and you are absolutely welcome to come out to the Purpich Center. I'll give you a personal tour if you would like.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler. That I will take you up on that. And just as a kind of a caution, I know that whether it's a business or whether it's anything else, that if you take a on buildings beyond your current capacity, you take on the maintenance and you take on a lot of other obligations forever and ever. And I've just, you know, I know that we're, I just want to make sure that we're not thinking about, that we are thinking about that for bonding hearings down the road, and that we're not burdening the Purpich Center with more facility than they're able to take on without causing hardship down the road.
That was the last question. Any closing comments?
My only comment, Madam Chair, in closing to Representative Dean would be that that was the very first question I asked the Purpich folks, whether this Crosswinds school would fit their mission, whether they had the capacity to handle its operations. And their first answers were good, and they've, I think, been very straightforward and pretty clear about what their capacity to do that is going forward. So I think this is an opportunity to continue a mission, but with different leadership, and I thank you for the time this morning.
Representative Fisher.
Very quickly, I would ask for support to allow the transference of these buildings, because it would allow some very unique opportunities happening in the education field that have come about in the past in a very rich collaborative environment, and allow those environments to continue that will make our state not only stronger, but also take care of the students who are currently in those programs. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And Representative Dean, are you willing to move the minutes of Thursday, March 21st?
No move.
Any corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, those minutes are approved. And we have informational hearings only on Thursday for a whole host of meeting is adjourned.